You know that moment when a sci-fi movie suddenly stops feeling like a wild fantasy and starts feeling, well, like a documentary?
Oh, yeah, like when the warp drive isn't the main plot device anymore, right?
Exactly. It just becomes how they get from point A to point B. It's just background. It's, infrastructure.
Right, the technology completely stops being the miracle and just becomes the plumbing.
Yeah.
Turn the tap, you expect the water, you don't think about the municipal reservoir miles away.
Yes, exactly. And today we are looking at a stack of sources that proves we are living in that exact transition moment right now.
We really are.
Welcome to the deep dive. We know you are here because you want to cut through the noise and get straight to the signal. And today we have got a truly fascinating roadmap for you.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Our source material is the Tech and Tech morning briefing from Monday, June 22, 2026. And at first glance, we are looking at like six seemingly totally disparate stories today.
Totally all over the map.
Right. We've got space travel, a smartphone carrier deal, cryptocurrency markets, and international cybersecurity.
It sounds like a completely random assortment of
It
news,
really does.
but there is a profound connective tissue hiding underneath it all. We are witnessing this massive global transition where digital and space technologies are shifting from these aspirational experimental projects into critical everyday infrastructure.
Right.
And as they do that, they're fundamentally challenging our concepts of trust, freedom, and who is actually in control.
Okay, let's unpack this because the scale of this transition is just staggering, and there is no better example of this than what is happening right now in orbit.
Absolutely.
So on Sunday, June 21, SpaceX launched their Starlink 1728 mission. It delivered 24 satellites into low Earth orbit. And
Right.
I read the overview in the briefing, but I had to do a double take at the actual operational numbers.
They are pretty mind-blowing.
Right. They aren't just launching rockets anymore. They are essentially running a space freight train at this point. Walk us through the math on this one.
Yeah, so the math is what proves this is no longer an experiment. It's just an industrial routine now. This was the 72nd Falcon 9 launch of 2026 alone.
Wow.
Right, so they are on pace for over 140 launches this year. That means a rocket is going to space every 2.6 days.
That's just nuts. Every 2.5 days.
But the truly crazy part is the reusability. The booster they used for this flight, booster B1063,
Yeah.
this was its 33rd flight.
Wait, 33?
33 trips to space, and it landed right back on the autonomous drone ship, "Of course I still love you," ready to be refurbished again.
33 flights for a single rocket. I mean, it's hard to even wrap your head around that if you grew up watching the space shuttle.
Oh, for sure.
Why does this completely upend the global aerospace industry?
To understand that, you really have to look at the mechanics of vertical integration and amortized costs. Historically, aerospace relied on these sprawling, disconnected supply chains.
Like lots of different contractors.
Exactly. You buy a valve from this company, an engine from that company, and everyone adds a 20% markup. SpaceX builds about 80% of its components entirely in-house.
Oh, wow.
80%.
Yeah. Down in Hawthorne, California, they are manufacturing two Merlin engines every single week.
Two rocket engines a week. That's incredible.
And when you do that, you eliminate the massive delays and markups that come with traditional aerospace supplier chains.
Which I guess sets the stage for the reusability to be the real kicker here.
Exacto.
If you think about traditional expendable rockets from legacy companies like United Launch Alliance or Arianespace, it is literally like buying a brand new 747 jetliner for a single flight from New York to LA,
Or then
just ditching it.
yeah.
Yeah.
Just throwing the plane into the ocean when you land. It's economically absurd once you see the alternative actually in action.
It is entirely absurd. A new Falcon 9 costs roughly $50 million to make. If you throw it away, that launch costs you $50 million plus your operations overhead.
Right.
But if you fly that same booster 33 times, like B1063, your amortized hardware cost plummets to under $2 million per launch.
That is a massive drop.
Huge.
Yeah.
Add a couple of million for fuel and refurbishment, and suddenly SpaceX can charge commercial customers $70 million, make a massive profit, and leave legacy competitors completely economically obsolete.
Because they just can't keep up.
They simply cannot compete with those margins because the underlying mechanism of their business model is completely broken.
So SpaceX is out here spending billions to build this radically open infrastructure in the sky.
Right.
These 6,000 Starlink satellites are beaming data down to Earth to eventually hit an end user device. But the irony is, down here on the ground, Telecom companies are doing the exact opposite.
Yeah, they really are.
They are trying to trap you in walled gardens to control how you access that data.
Yeah.
Let's look at T-Mobile, because they just launched what the briefing calls one of the most aggressive promotions of the year. A completely free iPhone 17 or 17 Pro.
Right. Free with some very heavy, very invisible quotation marks.
Yeah.
This is where we have to do the math and look at the traditional corporate playbook. To get this hardware, you have to switch to T-Mobile from another carrier and lock into their Experience Beyond plan, which sits at $100 a month.
Which sounds pretty high for a single line.
It is. If your current unlimited plan is, say, $70 a month, you are paying an extra $30 every single month for this new plan.
Right.
Over the mandatory 24-month lock-in period, that extra $30 a month adds up to $720.
Ah, I see where this is going.
So fundamentally, you are essentially paying $720 for a phone that retails for $899. It is a discount, sure, but the carrier is capturing your loyalty, guaranteeing your revenue for 2 years, and quietly subsidizing the hardware cost through that elevated service fee.
Now, I have to play devil's advocate here and push back on the cynicism just a little bit.
Fair enough.
Because the briefing does explicitly point out that the $100 Experience Beyond plan includes Netflix and Hulu.
That's true.
That is about a $25 monthly value right there. So if you are someone who already pays for those streaming services out of pocket and you actively use them, the math actually does work out in your favor.
Yeah, it does soften the blow.
You are getting the phone subsidized and keeping your streaming. You just have to be totally comfortable signing away your freedom to switch carriers for 2 full years.
And that is the crucial philosophical trade-off, right? Locking users into centralized, long-term contracts is exactly how traditional telecom scales its infrastructure. You trade your flexibility and mobility for subsidized access and, well, convenience.
But what if you want to build global infrastructure without that corporate lock-in?
That's the dream.
Because that is exactly what decentralized financial networks are attempting to do, and they are hitting some really fascinating growing pains as they become mainstream.
Oh, definitely.
The briefing noted a massive geopolitical development today regarding a potential U.S.-Iran peace deal within 60 days.
Right.
And look, we aren't here to weigh in on global politics or take a stance on international diplomacy.
No, not at all.
We just impartially want to look at how the financial markets reacted to this news based on the source text, because the reaction was incredibly weird.
It really was.
Despite this massive diplomatic breakthrough, Bitcoin barely blinked. It just hovered lazily around $64,000. It did not act like the reactive safe haven asset we are so used to seeing during big geopolitical shifts.
What's fascinating here is the underlying mechanism driving that muted response.
Which is?
Massive institutionalization.
Hmm.
The crypto market is fundamentally different today than it was even like a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We now have over $60 billion sitting in spot Bitcoin ETFs.
Wow.
This means that pension funds, massive endowments, and traditional insurance companies are holding the asset.
And they don't exactly panic sell or FOMO buy based on a morning news headline.
Precisely. Institutional money moves systematically. It is driven by complex risk models and quarterly portfolio rebalancing, which completely overrides the reactive emotional trading we used to see from the retail market.
Makes sense.
As a result, Bitcoin's price action is now much more tightly correlated with tech stocks and the Federal Reserve's interest rate policies than it is with international relations. It has basically become a mature, boring financial utility.
But if crypto is becoming this serious institutional utility, it suddenly runs into a very traditional real world problem.
Yeah, the infrastructure problem.
Exactly. How do you pay to maintain the plumbing? How do you fund the upkeep of a public utility when there is no centralized company like T-Mobile charging a $100 a month subscription fee to manage it?
That is the exact governance crisis staring through the Ethereum network right now. There is a new proposal from Clément Lesage, the founder of Claros, called Validator Redirected Revenue.
Okay.
The core idea is to force Ethereum validators to redirect up to 10% of their staking rewards to fund ecosystem infrastructure.
Okay. Before we get into the massive fight this is obviously causing, let's make sure we are all on the same page. What exactly is an Ethereum validator, and what are these staking rewards?
Great question. So to keep the network secure without a central bank processing everything, Ethereum relies on validators. These are basically users who lock up their own money, their own cryptocurrency, as collateral to prove they are trustworthy while they process transactions for the network.
Okay, so they have skin in the game.
Exactly. In exchange for doing that computational work and locking up their capital, the network automatically pays them a yield,
known as staking rewards.
Got it. So they are earning a return for keeping the lights on, but we aren't talking about pocket change here. The briefing notes, Ethereum validators are earning something like 500,000 to 700,000 ETH a year in total.
Right. So a 10% redirect means pulling 50,000 to 70,000 ETH away from those independent validators.
Wow.
At current market prices, that is roughly $120 million annually.
That's a massive tack.
And the proposal says if 51% of validators agree to this, it becomes mandatory for everyone, forced in that $120 million into a public goods fund.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because there is no easy answer here. It is essentially like a group of homeowners who all moved to a supposedly tax-free neighborhood, specifically because they hated city government. But now, it's a few years later, and they realize the roads are full of potholes, the streetlights are broken, and they actually need to be fixed. But because they rigidly refuse to have a centralized government, they can't agree on how to organize the repairs.
Exactly. Who's in charge?
Right. Do they elect a mayor? Well, no, that concentrates power. Do they use a suggestion box? That is easily manipulated by whoever shouts the loudest. They are even considering futarchy to figure out which roads to pave.
That analogy is absolutely spot on. It is the collision of ideological decentralization and practical sustainability.
Yeah.
And you mentioned futarchy. That's a system where instead of voting, they use prediction markets.
Okay, how does that work?
Basically, people place financial bets on which upgrades will improve the network's value the most, and the network blindly follows the money. It's an attempt to remove human politics from the equation entirely.
Which sounds great in theory, but...
But they have to figure this out. Because as these digital networks scale up to handle billions of dollars and form the backbone of our critical infrastructure, they become massive, glowing targets.
Right. When you put that much value online, it attracts a totally different breed of criminal. The 2025-2026 Interpol Cyber Threat Assessment Report just dropped in the briefing, and the statistics are legitimately terrifying.
They really are.
Across the Asia-Pacific region, in several countries, cybercrime now accounts for 30% of all recorded national crime. Let that sink in.
It's staggering.
Phishing is absolutely dominating the landscape, and when attackers move past phishing to successfully deploy ransomware, the average demand is hitting $1.2 million.
And we have to look at the mechanism behind this explosion. Why is this specific spike happening right now?
Why?
The answer is that artificial intelligence has completely democratized cybercrime.
Wait, democratized how? We've had phishing emails for decades.
Yeah.
You know, the classic, a prince needs you to wire him $500 emails with terrible spelling.
The classic Nigerian prince scam, yeah.
What is AI actually changing about the mechanics of these attacks?
It completely obliterated the barrier to entry by removing the need for human skill. Historically, running a highly successful targeted phishing campaign, what they call spear phishing, required a high level of technical ability.
You had to know what you were doing.
Right. Fluent language skills, a deep understanding of cultural context to craft a believable lure. Now, a criminal with zero coding or language skills can use a large language model to generate flawless, contextually aware phishing emails in 20 different languages instantly.
That is terrifying.
Add in deepfake technology, where it only takes seconds of audio to clone a CEO's voice to authorize a fraudulent wire transfer over the phone, and the threat landscape changes entirely.
The briefing also mentions RES ransomware as a service, which is just such a dark reflection of the legitimate tech industry. How does that actually function?
It functions exactly like a software franchise.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. You have these sophisticated developers who build the complex malware infrastructure. But instead of taking the risk of launching the attacks themselves, they lease out a user-friendly dashboard to unskilled affiliates.
So anyone can just buy access.
Exactly. The affiliates do the easy work of blasting out the AI-generated phishing links. When a victim clicks, the malware locks their system, the affiliate demands the ransom, and the developer automatically gets a 20% cut.
It is the industrialization of extortion.
And it creates a devastatingly asymmetric war.
Mm.
Think about it. The defenders, the network administrators, the hospital IT staff, they have to be right 100% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
They have to plug every single hole.
And the attackers.
They only need to be right once. They only need one exhausted employee to click one highly personalized link.
So, if the threats have industrialized AI on their side, how do platform operators actually protect us? Increasingly, the answer seems to be by putting us in a padded room and taking away your keys.
Yeah, that seems to be the trend.
Which brings us to a fascinating update hidden inside the Android ecosystem. The code inside Google Play Services version 26.125.31 reveals that Google is preparing to lock down Android.
They are.
Specifically, they may block access to developer options for users who have opted into advanced protection mode, primarily to prevent exploits through USB debugging.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this is the ultimate manifestation of the control versus freedom debate.
How so?
To understand why, you have to know that USB debugging is a feature that allows a computer to interface directly with the Android system at a very deep administrative level.
So it's powerful.
Very powerful. If malware gets hold of that, it's game over.
Yeah.
So Google is moving toward a model of paternalistic security. And it's not just this one feature. Mm. They are rolling out strict developer verification requirements in places like Brazil and Singapore right now, forcing users to jump through massive warning screens just to install unverified apps. They are trying to save users from themselves by restricting what the phone can do.
But I really have to push back hard on this approach, especially regarding the advanced protection mode. Because advanced protection is an opt-in feature designed specifically for high-risk users.
True.
We are talking about investigative journalists, political dissidents, human rights activists. These are people who are incredibly tech literate and are deliberately managing their own complex threat models.
Right. They know what they're doing.
Exactly. They often need developer options to sideload specific privacy tools or audit their own devices. Shouldn't we trust those specific users to manage their own risks? Why build an inherently open source platform just to fence it in the moment someone asks for higher security?
It is a totally valid critique, and it really highlights the paradox of securing infrastructure at scale. By attempting to protect the most vulnerable edge cases against incredibly sophisticated state-sponsored threats, Google is restricting the very flexibility that those power users might need to do their work.
Yeah.
The core assumption of the platform operator becomes that central control is inherently safer than distributed user agency. They basically believe the human is the weakest link.
So what does this all mean? We have talked about reusable rockets acting like freight trains, free iPhones that lock you in, crypto ETFs acting like boring tech stocks, Ethereum's HOA tax debate, AI franchising cybercrime, and Google locking down Android to protect us from ourselves, pull the threads together for us.
This raises an important question about what is actually holding all of this modern infrastructure together.
Whether
we are looking at SpaceX landing a booster for the 33rd time to prove they are reliable enough to build our orbital networks, mm-hmm. or Ethereum validators arguing over how to fund their public goods without creating a central authority, or Google and T-Mobile locking users into walled gardens for their own supposed benefit, the core currency of the digital age is not Bitcoin.
Right.
It isn't bandwidth. It is trust. The institutions, platforms, and protocols that can secure, scale, and maintain human trust are the ones that will completely define the next decade of infrastructure.
Trust. It all comes down to trust. And that leaves us with one final thought for you to mull over as you head into your week. We started by talking about infrastructure, how the sci-fi warp drive just becomes the plumbing in the background.
Yeah.
But today's sources highlight how human trust itself is being actively weaponized by AI phishing and deepfakes. If technology is becoming so incredibly good at faking human authenticity, at flawlessly mimicking a trusted voice or generating a trusted face, will the future of this zero trust architecture mean we eventually have to remove human judgment from our networks entirely?
Wow.
What happens when our infrastructure scales so massively that trusting a human being becomes the ultimate security risk? Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Stay curious, keep questioning the systems around you, and we will see you next time.